has everybody at the summer stage seen the Wheel of Life? National Buddhist Wheel of Life.
I don't think so.
I was searching out a poster that I used to have of it, which I thought years, and then I couldn't find them. But basically, the Wheel of Life is just a traditional way in Buddhism of representing the impact of greed, hatred, and ignorance, which are represented by three animals in the centre of this symbolic wheel. So there's the cock and the snake and the pig in the middle, which represent greed, hatred, and ignorance. And then around that, there's the falling and rising figures and the six different realms, which you can interpret as different mental states that you can get into. And then there's a symbology, which I won't go into now, but of a sort of causal process or conditioning process by which people can go round the wheel, so where they can get stuck in a cyclic deluded state, so the state known as samsara in traditional Buddhism. Yeah. Anyway, so I wanted to start with that just because I want to talk a bit about craving in Buddhism, and then just move on from that and talk about ways we can use that and ways we can sort of refine our understanding of desire and its role. So in the Wheel of Life and in Buddhism traditionally, craving or tamha is the Pali term, is the source of our problems, really, as it's understood here. So dukkha is the first noble truth, frustration or unsatisfactoriness or suffering, and craving is said to be the cause of that problem. So the Wheel of Life depicts craving as driving the whole thing, assisted by ignorance, and hatred is basically just inverted craving. So if there's something you don't want as opposed to something you do want. So it's all related to craving. But the Wheel of Life is a depiction of the state we're supposed to be in, with the idea, obviously, that we see how bad it is so that we can get out of it. And that's particularly represented traditionally by the fact that Mara, who's the figure of evil or unenlightenment, is depicted as holding up the wheel, and in fact biting it. So he's got big teeth and he's sort of about to chew onto us all in our unfortunate cyclic existence. So that leaves us with a basic issue, I think, almost just a conceptual issue. If craving, which is our experience of desiring things, you know, desiring everything from dinner to continuing to live, if that's the basic problem, what about craving for enlightenment? What about the how can we move on given that we can't do anything without wanting to do it? Buddhism does have a kind of response to that, in the traditional distinction between two kinds of craving, which are known as Dhammachanda and Kamachanda, which are written at the top there. Dhammachanda is craving for enlightenment or desire for enlightenment, as opposed to samsaric desire or desire driven just by cyclic wants. So one of my major problems with traditional Buddhism is that I'm not really satisfied with that distinction as a solution to the basic problem. And one of the issues with it, I think, is that it's ad hoc. What I mean by, well, ad hoc is a kind of fallacy which you can find in critical thinking. A classic example of it is sometimes known as the no true Scotsman fallacy. So the story goes that if you've got a Scotsman who's reading the papers and he sees there's been a load of trouble at a Liverpool match and these Liverpool supporters have been beating up Everton supporters. And he says, "Ah, no Scotsman would do that. It's just these English football fans that beat people up." And then someone else points out to him that there's been a riot at the Rangers versus Celtic match, and aren't those Scotsmen, you know, haven't those Scotsmen been behaving badly? And the Scotsman says, "Oh, no true Scotsman would behave like that." So what he's doing there is he's shifting his ground, he's changing the basis of his argument in order to maintain at least some version of his original position, rather than reconsidering it in the light of the evidence more fully. So that's what's known as an ad hoc argument. Now, I feel that's really what's going on with the traditional Buddhist view of craving, in that my sense is that Buddhism inherited this basic idea that desire is bad, which you get in the Indian tradition, which filters through into Hinduism. So an ascetic tradition, which then got modified slightly in order to fit in with the problem that was arising. You know, how do we explain how we want to get to enlightenment, and how does that fit in? But you know, if you just make this distinction between two kinds of desire, basically good desire and bad desire, then how do you tell the difference? Well, if the only difference is where it leads us to, what its consequences are, that's not enough for us to be able to distinguish in our experience what sort of desire we have. So if you've got a desire to go to a meditation class or something, that might be perhaps considered on the surface to be in line with the desire for enlightenment, but maybe you've seen somebody particularly attractive at this meditation class and your real motive for going is that you want to meet this person. So, it's difficult for us to tell unless we have a more rigorous, really, and clear understanding, I think, of what is what makes desire helpful or not. And also, I think desires themselves are deeply ambiguous things, so that can be associated with particular ideas about the world and particular goals. But often there can be several goals wrapped up with one desire, so we could have nearer goals and we could have further goals at the same time. You know, so what's one's goal in going to work in the morning? Well, perhaps further goal to advance one's career, but middle goal is to earn some money, and nearer goal is to avoid being reprimanded for being late or something. You know, there's all kinds of goals mixed up there, aren't there? And then, of course, why are you doing the job at all is a complicated issue. So, I'm not sure it's enough just to identify objects of desire and say, well, that's what makes desires good or bad. Another issue with the traditional Buddhist approach, I think, is that the two kinds of desires seem to me to be conflated, that they're particularly where life and death are seen as due to samsaric desire, so it's mixed up with the belief in rebirth and the idea that we continue not just to do things which are not sustainable or not good for us in the long term during our lives, but also the very fact that we continue to exist is seen as a result of craving. It's obviously our desire to exist, it seems to me, is it's a condition of our existence. It's a condition of us of everything that's positive in our existence, apart from as well as everything that may be negative. So life is a precondition for any desire, sure, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. And then, relating to what we talked about yesterday, that there's obviously this contradiction between the middle way and this belief in karma and rebirth, which is a metaphysical belief. So I think there is another way of thinking about this, which can take some of the best elements from the Buddhist account of craving, but avoid these kinds of difficulties. And the way I prefer to see it is that desire is just energy. So there's nothing good or bad about desire in itself. Desire is just what leads us to act in certain ways. It's obviously deeply ingrained into us genetically and biologically. It's part of our physical way of operating. The issue with desire, well, it's to me the more useful model of what makes desire helpful or unhelpful is much more to do with whether desires conflict than with the desires themselves. So it's the conflicts between different desires that create problems for us. Whether those conflicts take place at an individual level within our psyches, you know, if we're encountering conflicts within ourselves, which stop us meditating or whatever, on the one hand, or up to world wars, you know, at the highest level. But, you know, world wars are still basically conflicts between desires. You know, different people want different things, so they fight each other. So, even the desires that are conflicting, I don't think are bad. It's just the whole situation would be better if those desires weren't conflicting, if they weren't. And the basic reason for that is conflicting desires can't both be satisfied. You know, they'll just conflict with each other rather than fulfilling what their energies are directed towards, whatever that is.
Coming back to the integration thing, though, I suppose. I don't know much about tantric Buddhism and tantra in general, but I kind of am aware of themes of integrating supposedly positive and negative desires within that. I don't know whether you have any familiarity with those traditions or can tie them in with
only to some extent. There is a guy who writes on the web called David Chapman. I don't know if you've come across him.
Yeah.
Yes. Who is a tantric and sees that. I've been in quite a lot of correspondence with him, but he has quite a positive view of my work. But he's also sees it as compatible with tantrism as he interprets it. But in a way, I kind of think it's the kind of tantrism he's ended up with is, well, it's a very long way from what most Tibetan Buddhists would identify with tantrism. You can take any tradition and you can adapt it in ways that gradually address conditions better. And I think that's equally true of Tibetan Buddhism and Buddhist tradition.
Yeah. I was kind of referring to tantra in terms of the kinds of people I've spoken to in Edinburgh who are into it. And I think it's got more of a, what they're doing has got more of an Indian flavour than a Tibetan flavour.
Right.
I mean, like I said, I've just got an impression of what they're talking about rather than any detailed knowledge. But it did strike me that some of those themes were very pertinent to the middle way.
There is a distinction which I'm not entirely sure is addressed in tantrism between just rebalancing and integrating. Yeah, so some of tantrism seems to be a reaction against the straight-laced rule following in earlier forms of, you know, in Hinayana Buddhism particularly. And so breaking rules, you know, becomes, breaking rules with awareness becomes an important goal. Hence the controversial ceremonies involving sex and blood and so on. Which are all supposed to be done with full awareness and, so obviously that might be kind of therapeutic thing to do if you've been particularly caught up with this set of rules. Well, do something completely different that breaks all the rules and do it with awareness and maybe that'll be good for you. But I guess I feel we're in a slightly different situation with different sets of rules that we're used to obeying.
Mm-hmm.
maybe we can find our own sort of tantric methods. Also, tantrism is very caught up with guru, the function of gurus, yeah, and idealization of particular individuals as having all the answers,
yeah,
and representing the Buddha in a more immediate way.
Mm.